Athaklana inclined her head. She really did not have time for this. If she spent too long here, Lieutenant McHugh might suspect that this was where her missing commander was being hidden. The Marines had already swooped down on several possible hiding places.
The upshot might have been to force Earth to finance a new site as a replacement, she said.
Pratha Chulthorn stared at her.
But we're at war,
she nodded, misunderstanding him.
Exactly. One cannot allow war without rules and powerful neutral forces to enforce them. The alternative would be barbarism.
The man's sour look was her only answer.
Besides, to destroy the site would have implied that humans do not want to see their clients tested and judged for promotion. But now it is the Gubru who must pay Honor Guild for this truce. Your clan has gained a segment of status by being the aggrieved party, unavenged. This sliver of propriety could turn out to be crucial in the days ahead.
Pratha Chulthorn frowned. For a moment he seemed to concentrate, as if a thread of her logic hung almost within reach. She felt his attention shimmer as he tried, but then it faded. He grimaced and spat again.
What a load of crap! Show me dead birds, that's currency I can count. Pile them up to the level of this cage, little Miss Ambassador's daughter, and maybe, just maybe, I'll let you live when I finally break out of here.
Athaklana shivered. She knew how futile it was to try to hold a man such as this prisoner. He should have been kept drugged. He should have been killed. But she could not bring herself to do either, or to further prejudice the fate of the Chims in her cabal by involving them in such crimes.
"Good day, Major,"
she said, and turned to go. He did not shout as she left. In a way, the parsimonious use he made of his threats made those few seem all the more menacing and believable. She took a hidden trail from the secret glade over a shoulder of the mountain, past warm springs that hissed and steamed uncertainly. At the ridge crest, Athaklana had to draw in her tendrils to keep them from being battered in the autumn wind. Few clouds could be seen in the sky, but the air was hazy with dust blowing in from faraway deserts. Hanging from a nearby branch, she encountered one of the parachute-like kite and spore pod combinations blown up here from some field of plate ivy. The autumn dispersal was fully underway now. Fortunately, it had begun in earnest more than 2 days ago, before the Gubru announced their truce. That fact might turn out to be very important indeed. The day felt odd, more so than at any time since that night of terrible dreams, shortly before she climbed this mountain to wrestle with her parents' fierce legacy.
Perhaps the Gubru are warming up their hyperwave shunt again.
She had since learned that her fit of dreams on that fateful night had coincided with the invaders' first test of their huge new facility. Their experiments had let surges of unallocated probability loose in all directions, and those who were psychically sensitive reported bizarre mixtures of deathly dread and hilarity. That sort of mistake did not sound like the normally meticulous Gubru, and it seemed to be a validation of Fibbon Bulger's report that the enemy had serious leadership problems. Was that why Tutsunukan collapsed so suddenly and violently that evening? Was all that loose energy responsible for the terrific power of her Sususstruthun rapport with Uthakalving? Could that and the subsequent tests of those great engines explain why the gorillas had begun behaving so very strangely? All Athaklana knew for certain was that she felt nervous and afraid.
Soon, she thought. It will all approach climax very soon.
She had descended halfway down the trail leading back to her tent when a pair of breathless chims emerged from the forest, hurrying uphill toward her.
"Miss! Miss!"
one of them breathed. The other held his side, panting audibly. Her initial reading of their panic triggered a brief hormone rush, which only subsided slightly when she traced their fear and kenned that it did not come from an enemy attack. Something else had them terrified, half out of their wits.
"Miss Athaclena,"
the first chim gasped.
"You gotta come quick."
"What is it, Petri? What's happening?"
He swallowed.
"It's the Rillas. We can't control them anymore."
"So," she thought.
For more than a week, the gorillas' low atonal music had been driving their chim guardians to nervous fits.
"What are they doing now?"
"They're leaving,"
the second messenger wailed plaintively. She blinked.
"What did you say?"
Petrie's brown eyes were filled with bewilderment.
"They're leaving. They just got up and left. They're heading for the Sind, and there doesn't seem to be anything we can do to stop them."
Chapter 82 Who's the Calling? Their progress toward the mountains had slackened considerably recently. More and more of Kalt's time seemed to be spent laboring over his makeshift instruments and in arguing with his Timbrimi companion.
"How quickly things change," Utha Calving thought.
He had labored long and hard to bring Kalt to this fever pitch of suspicion and excitement, and now he found himself recalling with fondness their earlier peaceful comradeship, the long, lazy days of gossip and reminiscences and common exile, however frustrating they had seemed at the time. Of course, that had been when Utha Calving was whole, when he had been able to look upon the world through Timbrimi eyes and the softening veil of whimsy. Now, Utha Calving knew that he had been considered dour and serious by others of his race. Now, though, they would surely think him crippled, perhaps better off dead.
"Too much was taken from me," he thought,
while Kalt muttered to himself in the corner of their shelter. Outside, heavy gusts blew through the veldt grasses. Moonlight brushed long hill crests that resembled sluggish ocean waves locked amid a rolling storm.
"Did she actually have to tear away so much?" he wondered,
without really being able to feel or care very much. Of course, Athaclena had hardly known what she was doing that night when she decided in her need to call in the pledge her parents had made. Sustruthun was not something one trained for. A recourse so drastic and used so seldom could not be well described by science. And by its very nature, Sustruthun was something one could do but once in one's lifetime. Anyway, now that he looked back upon it, Utha Calving remembered something he hadn't noticed at the time. That evening had been one of great tension. Hours beforehand, he had felt disturbing waves of energy, as if ghostly half-glyphs of immense power were throbbing against the mountains. Perhaps that explained why his daughter's call had carried such strength. She had been tapping some outside source. And he remembered something else. In the Sustruthun storm Athaclena triggered, not everything torn from him had gone to her. Strange that he had not thought of it until now. But Utha Calving now seemed vaguely to recall some of his essences flying past her. But where they had actually been bound, he could not even imagine. Perhaps to the source of those energies he had felt earlier. Perhaps. Utha Calving was too tired to come up with rational theories.
"Who knows?" Maybe they were drawn in by Garthlings.
It was a poor joke, not even worth a tiny smile. And yet the irony was encouraging. It showed that he had not lost absolutely everything.
I am certain of it now with the calling.
Kalt's voice was low and confident as the Thenanin turned to face him. He put aside the instrument he had constructed out of odd items salvaged from the wrecked pinnace.
Certain of what, colleague?
Certain that our separate suspicions are focusing in on a probable fact. See here, the data you showed me, your private spools regarding these Garthling creatures, allowed me to tune my detector until I am now sure that I have found the residence I was seeking.
You are?
Uther Kalving didn't know what to make of this. He had never expected Kalt to find actual confirmation of mythical beasts.
I know what concerns you, my friend, Kalt said, raising one massive leather-plated hand. You fear that my experiments will draw down upon us the attention of the Gubru, but rest assured, I am using a very narrow band and am reflecting my beam off the nearer moon. It is very unlikely they would ever be able to localize the source of my puny little probe.
But, Uther Kalving shook his head.
What are you looking for?
Kalt's breathing slits puffed.
A certain type of cerebral resonance.
It is quite technical, he said. It has to do with something I read in your tapes about these Garthling creatures. What little data you had seemed to indicate that these pre-sentient beings might have brains not too dissimilar to those of Earthlings, or Timbrimi. Uther Kalving was amazed by the way Kalt used his fake data with such celerity and enthusiasm. His former self would have been delighted.
So?
He asked.
So? Let me see if I can explain with an example. Take humans.
Please, Uther Kalving inserted without much enthusiasm, more out of habit.
Earthlings represent one of many paths which can be taken to arrive eventually at intelligence. Theirs involved the use of two brains that later became one.
Uther Kalving blinked. His own mind was working so slowly.
You are speaking of the fact that their brains have two partially independent hemispheres?
And while these halves are similar and redundant in some ways, in others they divide the labor. The split is even more pronounced among their Neo-Dolphin clients. Before the Gubru arrived, I was studying data on Neo-Chimpanzees, which are similar to their patrons in many respects. One of the things the humans had to do early in their uplift program was find ways to unite the functions of the two halves of pre-sentient chimpanzee brains comfortably into one consciousness. Until that was done, neo-chimpanzees would suffer from a condition called bicamerality. Kalt droned on, gradually letting his jargon grow more and more technical, eventually leaving Uther Kalving far behind. The arcana of cerebral function seemed to fill their shelter, as if in thick smoke. Uther Kalving felt almost tempted to craft a glyph to commemorate his own boredom, but he lacked the energy even to stir his tendrils.
So, the residence appears to indicate that there are, indeed, bicameral minds within the range of my instrument.
Ah, yes, Uther Kalving thought. Back in Port Helena, at a time when he had still been a clever crafter of complex schemes, he had suspected that Kalt might turn out to be resourceful. That was one reason why Uther Kalving chose for a confederate an atavistic chim. Kalt was probably picking up traces from poor Jojo, whose throwback brain was in many ways similar to fallow, non-uplifted chimpanzees of centuries ago. Jojo no doubt retained some of this bicamerality characteristic Colt spoke of. Finally, Colt concluded,
"I am therefore quite convinced from your evidence and my own that we cannot delay any longer. We must somehow get to and use a facility for sending interstellar messages."
"How do you expect to do that?"
Uther Calding asked in mild curiosity. Colt's breathing slits pulsed in obvious rare excitement.
"Perhaps we can sneak or bluff or fight our way to the planetary branch library, claim sanctuary, and then invoke every priority under the 50 Sons of Thenon. Perhaps there is another way. I do not care if it means stealing a Gubru starship. Somehow we must get word to my clan."
Was this the same creature who had been so anxious to flee Port Helenia before the invaders arrived? Colt seemed as changed outwardly as Uther Calding felt inwardly. The Thenanin's enthusiasm was a hot flame, while Uther Calding had to stoke his own carefully.
"You wish to establish a claim on the pre-sentience before the Gubru manage it?"
he asked.
"Aye, and why not? To save them from such horrible patrons, I would lay down my life. But there may be need for much haste. If what we have overheard on our receiver is true, emissaries from the Institutes may already be on their way to Garth. I believe the Gubru are planning something big. Perhaps they have made the same discovery. We must act quickly if we are not to be too late."
Uther Calding nodded.
"One more question, then, distinguished colleague."
He paused.
"Why should I help you?"
Colt's breath sighed like a punctured balloon, and his ridge crest collapsed rapidly. He looked at Uther Calding with an expression as emotion-laden as any that Tim Brimmy had ever seen upon the face of a Dur Thenanin.
"It would greatly benefit the pre-sentience," he hissed. "Their destiny would be far happier."
"Perhaps. Arguable. Is that it, though? Are you relying on my altruism alone?"
Outwardly, Colt seemed offended that anything more should be asked. Still, could he really be surprised? He was, after all, a diplomat and understood that the best and firmest deals are based on open self-interest.
It would greatly help my own political party if I delivered such a treasure. We would probably win government," he suggested.
"A slight improvement over the intolerable is not enough to get excited about."
Uther Calding shook his head.
"You still haven't explained to me why I should not stake a claim for my own clan. I was investigating these rumors before you. We Tim Brimmy would make excellent patrons for these creatures."
You Kif-Mimferingi?
The phrase stood for something vaguely equivalent to juvenile delinquents. It was almost enough to make Uther Calding smile again. Colt shifted uncomfortably. He made a visible effort to retain diplomatic composure.
"You, Tim Brimmy, have not the strength, the power to back up such a claim," he muttered.
"At last,"
Uther Calding thought.
"Truth."
In times like this, under circumstances as muddy as these, it would take more than mere priority of application to settle an adoption claim on a pre-sentient race. Many other factors would officially be considered by the Uplift Institute. And the humans had a saying that was especially appropriate. Possession is 9 points of the law. It certainly applied here.
"So we are back to question number 1.
Uther Calding nodded.
If neither we Timbrimmy nor the Terrans can have the Garthlings, why should we help you get them?
Kalt rocked from one side to the other, as if he were trying to work his way off a hot seat. His misery was blatantly obvious, as was his desperation. Finally he blurted forth,
I can almost certainly guarantee a cessation of all hostilities by my clan against yours.
Not enough.
Uther Kalving came back quickly.
What more could you ask of me?
Kalt exploded.
An actual alliance, a promise of Thenanin aid against those now laying siege upon Timbrim.
But...
And the guarantee must be firm, in advance, to take effect, whether or not these pre-sentients of yours actually turn out to exist.
Kalt stammered.
You cannot expect...
Oh, but I can. Why should I believe in these Garthling creatures? To me, they have only been intriguing rumors. I never told you I believed in them. And yet, you want me to risk my life to get you to message facilities. Why should I do that, without a guarantee of benefit for my people?
This is unheard of.
Nevertheless, it is my price. Take it or leave it.
For a moment Uther Kalving felt a thrilled suspicion. He was about to witness the unexpected. It seemed as if Kalt might lose control, might actually burst forth into violence. At the sight of those massive fists clenching and unclenching rapidly, Uther Kalving actually felt his blood stir with change enzymes. A surge of nervous fear made him feel more alive than he had in days.
It shall be as you demand,
Kalt growled at last.
Good.
Uther Kalving sighed as he relaxed. He drew forth his data well.
Let us work out together how to parse this for a contract.
It took more than an hour to get the wording right. After it was finished, and when they had both signified their affirmation on each copy, Uther Kalving gave Kalt one record pellet and kept the second for himself.
Amazing,
he thought at that point. He had planned and schemed to bring about this day. This was the second half of his grand jest, fulfilled at last. To have fooled the Gubru was wonderful. This was simply unbelievable. And yet right now, Uther Kalving found himself feeling numb rather than triumphant. He did not look forward to the climb ahead, a furious race into the steep towers of the Mulan Range, followed by a desperate attempt that would, no doubt, result only in the two of them dying side by side.
You know, of course, Uther Kalving, that my people will not carry out this bargain if I turn out to be mistaken. If there are no Garthlings after all, the Thenanin will repudiate me. They will pay diplomatic guild to buy out this contract, and I will be ruined.
Uther Kalving did not look at Kalt. This was another reason for his sense of depressed detachment, certainly.
A great jokester is not supposed to feel guilt,
he told himself.
Perhaps I have spent too much time around humans.
The silence stretched on for a while longer, each of them brooding in his own thoughts. Of course, Kalt would be repudiated. Of course, the Thenanin were not about to be drawn into an alliance, or even peace, with the Earth Timbrimi Entente. All Uther Kalving had ever hoped to accomplish was to sow confusion among his enemies. If Kalt should, by some miracle, manage to get his message off and truly draw Thenanin armadas to this backwater system, then two great foes of his people would be drawn into a battle that would drain them. A battle over nothing. Over a non-existent species. Over the ghosts of creatures murdered 50,000 years ago.
Such a great jest!
I should be happy. Thrilled.
Sadly, he knew that he could not even blame Ustrusun for his inability to take pleasure out of this. It was not Athoklena's fault that the feeling clung to him, the feeling that he had just betrayed a friend.
Ah, well,
Utha Kalding consoled himself.
It is all probably moot anyway. To get Kalt the kind of message facilities he needs now will take 7 more miracles, each greater than the last.
It seemed fitting that they would probably die together in the attempt, uselessly. In his sadness, Utha Kalding found the energy to lift his tendrils slightly. They fashioned a simple glyph of regret as he raised his head to face Kalt. He was about to speak when something very surprising suddenly happened. Utha Kalding felt a presence wing past in the night. He started, but no sooner had it been there than it was gone.
Did I imagine it? Am I falling apart?
Then it was back. He gasped in surprise, kenning as it circled the tent in an ever-tightening spiral, brushing at last against the fringes of his indrawn aura. He looked up, trying to spot something that whirled just beyond the fringe of their shelter.
What am I doing? Trying to see a glyph?
He closed his eyes and let the un-thing approach. Utha Kalding opened a kenning.
Puritumbrio,
he cried. Kalt swiveled.
What is it, my friend? What?
But Utha Kalding had risen. As if drawn up by a string, he stepped out into the cool night. The breeze brought odors to his nostrils as he sniffed, using all his senses to seek in the acherontic darkness.
Where are you?
Utha Kalding called.
Who is there?
2 figures stepped forward into a dim pool of moonlight.
So it is true,
Utha Kalding thought. A human had sought him out with an empathy sending, one so skillful it might have come from a young Timbrimmy. And that was not the end to surprises. He blinked at the tall, bronzed, bearded warrior, who looked like nothing but one of the heroes of those pre-contact earthling barbarian epics, and let out another cry of amazement as he suddenly recognized Robert Oneagle, the playboy son of the planetary coordinator.
Good evening, sir, Robert said as he stopped a few meters away and bowed.
Standing a little behind Robert, the neo-chimpanzee Jojo wrung his hands nervously. This certainly was not according to the original plan. He did not meet Utha Kalding's eyes.
Vuhuman Idetus!
Kalt exclaimed in Galactic 6.
Utha Kalding, what is a human doing here?
Robert bowed again. Enunciating carefully, he made formal greetings to both of them, including their full species names. Then he went on in Galactic 7.
I have come a long way, honored gentle beings, in order to invite you all to a party.
Chapter 83 Bibbin.
Easy, Tycho, easy.
The normally placid animal bucked and pulled at its reins. Bibbin, who had never been much of a horseman, was forced to dismount hurriedly and grab the animal's halter.
There now, relax, he soothed. It's just another transport going by. We've heard 'em all day. It'll be gone soon.
As he promised, the shrieking whine faded as the flying machine passed quickly overhead and disappeared beyond the nearby trees, traveling in the direction of Port Helena. A lot had changed since Fibbin had first come this way, mere weeks after the invasion. Then he had walked in sunshine down a busy highway, surrounded by spring's verdant colors. Now he felt blustery winds at his back as he passed through a valley showing all the early signs of a bitter winter. Half the trees had already dropped their leaves, leaving them in drifts across meadows and lanes. Orchards were bare of fruit, and the back roads devoid of traffic. Surface traffic, that is. Overhead, the swarm of transport seemed incessant. Gravitics teased his peripheral nerves as Goobroo machines zoomed past. The first few times, his hackles had risen from more than just the pulsing fields. He had expected to be challenged, to be stopped, perhaps to be shot on sight. But in fact, the Galactics had ignored him altogether, apparently not deigning to distinguish one lonely Chim from others who had been sent out to help with the harvest, or the specialists who had begun staffing a few of the ecological management stations once again. Bibin had spoken with a few of the latter, many of them old acquaintances. They told of how they had given their parole in exchange for freedom and low-level support to resume their work. There wasn't much to be done, of course, with winter coming on, but at least there was a program again, and the Goobroo seemed quite satisfied to leave them alone to do their work. The invaders were, indeed, preoccupied elsewhere. The real focus of galactic activity seemed to be over to the southwest, toward the spaceport.
"And the ceremonial site," Bibin reminded himself.
He didn't really know what he was going to do in the unlikely event he actually made it through to town. What would happen if he just marched right up to the shabby house that had been his former prison? Would the suzerain of propriety take him back? Would Galet? Would she even be there? He passed a few Chims dressed in muffled cloaks, who desultorily picked through the stubble in a recently harvested field. They did not greet him, nor did he expect them to. Gleaning was a job generally given the poorest sort of probationer. Still, he felt their gaze as he walked Tycho toward Port Helena. After the animal had calmed a bit, Bibin clambered back onto the saddle and rode. He had considered trying to re-enter Port Helena the way he left it, over the wall, at night. After all, if it had worked once, why not a second time? Anyway, he had no wish to meet up with the followers of the suzerain of Cost and Caution. It was tempting. Somehow, though, he figured that once was lucky, twice would be simple stupidity. Anyway, the choice was made for him when he rounded a bend and found himself staring at a Goobroo guard post. Two battle robots of sophisticated design whirled and focused upon him.
"Easy does it, guys,"
Bibin said it more for his own benefit than theirs. If they were programmed to shoot on sight, he never would have seen them in the first place. In front of the blockhouse there sat a squat armored hovercraft propped up on blocks. Two pairs of three-toed feet stuck out from underneath. And it did not take much knowledge of Galactic 3 to tell that the chirp mutterings were expressing frustration. When the robot's warning whistled forth, there came a sharp bang under the hover, followed by an indignant squawk. Soon a pair of hooked beaks poked out of the shadows. Yellow eyes watched him unblinkingly. One of the disheveled Goobroo rubbed its dented head frill. Bibin pressed his lips together to fight back a smile. He dismounted and approached until he was even with the bunker, puzzled when neither the aliens nor the machine spoke to him. He stopped before the two Goobroo and bowed low. They looked at each other and twittered irritably to each other. From one there came something that sounded like a resigned moan. The two Talon soldiers emerged from under the disabled machine and stood up. Each of them returned a very slight but noticeable nod. Silence stretched. One of the Goobroo whistled another faint sigh and brushed dust from its feathers. The other simply glared at Bibin.
Now what? He tried to think, but what was he supposed to do? Fibbon's toes itched. He bowed again, then with a dry mouth, he backed away and took the horse's tether. With affected nonchalance, he started walking toward the dark fence surrounding Port Helena, now visible just a kilometer ahead. Tycho nickered, swished his tail, and cut loose an aromatic crepitation.
Tycho, please, Fibbon thought.
When a bend in the road at last cut off all view of the Gubru, Fibbon sank to the ground. He just sat and shook for a few moments.
Well, he said at last, I guess there really is a truce after all.
After that, the guard post at the town gate was almost anticlimactic. Fibbon actually enjoyed making the Talon soldiers acknowledge his bow. He remembered some of what Galet had taught him about galactic protocol. Grudging acknowledgement from the client class, Kwaku, had been vital to achieve. To get it from the Gubru was delicious. It also clearly meant that the suzerain of propriety was holding out. It had not yet given in. Fibbon left a trail of startled chims behind him as he rode Tycho at a gallop through the back streets of Port Helena. One or two of them shouted at him, but at that moment he had no thought except to hurry toward the site of his former imprisonment. When he arrived, however, he found the iron gate open and untended. The watch globes had vanished from the stone wall. He left Tycho to graze in the unkempt garden and beat aside a couple of limp plate ivy parachutes that festooned the open doorway.
Galet!
He shouted. The probationer guards were gone, too. Dust balls and scraps of paper blew in through the open door and rolled down the hall. When he came to the room he had shared with Galet, Fibbon stopped and stared. It was a mess. Most of the furnishings were still there, but the expensive sound system and holo wall had been torn out, no doubt taken by the departing probies. On the other hand, Fibbon saw his personal data well sitting right where he had left it that night. Galet's was gone. He checked the closet. Most of their clothes still hung there. Clearly she hadn't packed. He took down the shiny ceremonial robe he had been given by the suzerain staff. The silky material was almost glass smooth under his fingers. Galet's robe was missing.
Oh, good all,
Fibbon moaned. He spun about and dashed down the hall. It took only a second to leap into the saddle, but Tycho barely looked up from his feeding. Fibbon had to kick and yell until the beast began to comprehend some of the urgency of the situation. With a yellow sunflower still hanging from his mouth, the horse turned and clomped through the gate and back onto the street. Once there, Tycho brought his head down and gamely gathered momentum. They made quite a sight, galloping down the silent, almost empty streets, the robe and the flower flapping like banners in the wind. But few witnessed the wild ride until they finally approached the crowded wharves. It seemed as if nearly every chim in town was there. They swarmed along the waterfront, a churning mass of brown, calipose bodies dressed in autumn parkas, their heads bobbing like the waters of the bay just beyond. More chims leaned precariously over the rooftops, and some even hung from drainage spouts. It was a good thing Fibbon wasn't on foot. Tycho was really quite helpful, as he snorted and nudged startled chims aside with his nose. From his perch on the horse's back, Fibbon soon was able to spy what some of the commotion was about. About a half kilometer out into the bay, a dozen fishing vessels could be seen operating under neo-chimpanzee crews. A cluster of them jostled and bumped near a sleek white craft that glistened in cliquant contrast to the battered trawlers. The Gubru vessel was dead in the water. Two of the avian crew members stood atop its cockpit, twittering and waving their arms, offering instructions which the Chim seamen politely ignored. As they tied hawsers to the crippled craft and began gradually towing it toward the shore.
So what? Big deal,
Fibbin thought. So a Gubru patrol boat suffered a breakdown. For this, all the Chims in town had spilled out into the streets? The citizens of Port Helena really must be hard up for entertainment. Then he realized that only a few of the town folk were actually watching the minor rescue in the harbor. The vast majority stared southward, out across the bay.
Oh!
Fibbin's breath escaped in a sigh, and he too was momentarily struck speechless. New shining towers stood atop the far mesa where the colonial spaceport lay. The lambent monoliths looked nothing like Gubru transports or their hulking globular battleships. Instead, these resembled glimmering steeples, spires which towered high and confident, manifesting a faith and tradition more ancient than life on Earth. Tiny winklings of light lifted from the tall starships.
Carrying galactic dignitaries,
Fibbin guessed, and cruised westward, drawing nearer along the arc of the bay. At last the aircraft joined a spiral of traffic descending over South Point. That was where everyone in Port Helena seemed to sense that something special was going on. Unconsciously, Fibbin guided Tycho through the crowd until he arrived at the edge of the main wharf. There, a chain of Chims wearing oval badges held back the crowd.
So there are proctors again,
Fibbin realized.
The probationers proved unreliable, so the Gubru had to reinstate civil authority.
A Chen wearing the brassard of a proctor corporal grabbed Tycho's halter and started to speak.
Hey, Bob, you can't...
Then he blinked.
Ifni, is that you, Fibbin?
Fibbin recognized Barnaby Fulton, one of the Chims who had been involved in Galet's early urban underground. He smiled, though his thoughts were far across the choppy waters.
Hello, Barnaby. Haven't seen you since the Valley Uprising. Glad to see you still scratching.
Now that attention had been drawn his way, Chens and Chimmy started nudging each other and whispering in hushed voices. He heard his own name repeated. The susurration of the crowd ebbed as a circle of silence spread around him. Two or three of the staring Chims reached out to touch Tycho's heavy flanks, or Fibbin's leg, as if to verify that they were real. Barnaby made a visible effort to match Fibbin's insouciance.
Whatever it itches, Fibbin. One rumor had it you were supposed to be over there.
He gestured toward the monumental activity taking place across the harbor.
Another said you'd busted out and taken to the hills. A third. What did the third say?
Barnaby swallowed.
Some said your number'd come up.
Huh, Fibbin commented softly.
I guess all of them were right.